from the floor all the way up to the third floor was just engulfed in flames.
A large fire that forced some Midtown Anchorage apartment residents to jump from the third floor kills two people and injures 16. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 15th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Bill Walker issues a disaster declaration for opioid abuse to speed up the distribution of anti-overdose medication.
It's a way to save a life until definitive medical care can be made available.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Join Alaskan leaders for an online discussion about civility in the last frontier Thursday, February 23rd from 5:30 to 7 at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
A Midtown Anchorage apartment building caught fire early this morning, killing two people and injuring 16 others. A portion of the three-story Royal Suite Lodge has collapsed from the blaze, and the cause is currently unknown. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
During late morning, firefighters were still using chainsaws to cut away smoldering boards and spraying down portions of the building with fire hoses. Royal Suite residents Tequila Parker Hernandez and her husband Juan stand in the complex's neighboring building, which was untouched. They lived in a first-floor apartment in the burned structure. She says she first heard an alarm around 2:30 a.m.
And we woke up, I opened the front door, and down on the far end of this building, it was from the floor all the way up to the third floor, was just engulfed in flames. So we grabbed a couple things and went out to the parking lot, and the fire just spread.
The Anchorage Fire Department says 34 fire trucks and engines responded to the blaze. 16 people were injured, including some who jumped out of third-story windows. At least four were in critical condition. Two others died, including a 38-year-old woman. As of midday, the building was not structurally stable enough for fire investigators to enter and identify the cause of the fire. Anchorage Fire Department Deputy Chief Jody Hetrick says it's hard to estimate when they will be able to go in. A few dozen residents are taking shelter at the Spinard Rec Center, where the Red Cross has set up cots and is distributing food and some basic clothing. Red Cross Representative David Williams says the shelter will likely run for 2 days, and workers will be connecting people to agencies who can help them make longer-term plans.
When people have gone through a loss like this, very often there's a sense of loss of control of their lives in general. And if they can start making decisions about where they're moving on with their lives, then that's helping them to recover.
Robert Thomas and his family say they want to find a new place as quickly as possible, but it may be hard to come up with the rent money. He explains they've only been living at the Royal Suites for 2 weeks. Before that, he and his girlfriend had spent about 2 months living at the Brother Francis shelter.
We lost everything, and we were saving and scrimping just to get in. And now 2 weeks later, we're already out again, so we're starting over completely from scratch.
He says when the fire alarm first went off, he didn't think it was real because there had been a false alarm just a week before.
So we were kind of taking our time, and then the manager came by and was banging on the door and saying, "This is not a drill. There really is a fire. Everybody out. Please get out now. Just get out, get out, get out."
They escaped their apartment and eventually took shelter at the rec center. The 40-year-old building contained 30 units. It's unknown how many people were present during the fire. If you're trying to connect to someone, call the Red Cross at 230-4472. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Governor Bill Walker has declared opioid abuse a state disaster. The order puts in place a program for broad distribution of the overdose medication naloxone. Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer. Dr. Butler says the governor's disaster declaration today allows for a standing order, in effect a prescription, that allows access to naloxone and training for administering it to organizations and individuals beyond healthcare professionals who come into contact with those at risk of overdose.
people will oftentimes overdose in the presence of other people. And those people may have a lack of medical training. They certainly don't have access to naloxone until we now have that ability to provide that. And as a result, people may die before they actually get the needed medical care. So I think of this as being very similar to performing CPR or using a tourniquet for severe bleeding. It's a way to save a life until definitive medical care can be made available.
How effective is naloxone?
Naloxone is able to knock the opioid off the receptor in the brain and actually stimulate the respiratory center again so that breathing will resume. It's very important, though, that people understand that this is, first of all, of course, not a cure for addiction, but also doesn't make everything all right, that it's still very important to call 911.
From 2009 to 2015, the number of heroin-associated deaths has more than quadrupled. What has been going on in this 6 years that we're seeing these terrifically higher numbers?
This opioid epidemic has come in three waves, starting with overdoses due to use of prescription opioids or misuse of prescription opioids that began some 10 to 15 years ago. Roughly 5, 6, 7 years ago, cheaper, purer heroin became much more available, particularly in the western parts of the United States, including Alaska. And then over the past year or two, we've begun to see more and more use of fentanyl and some of the synthetic opioids, some of which actually can be purchased over the internet. Many of these come out of labs in Asia, particularly in China. And some of these drugs are very powerful.
To your knowledge, has this been used ever before in the state for a public health issue?
I'm not aware of any instance where a disaster declaration for a public health emergency has been used.
Dr. Jay Butler is the state's chief medical officer and the head of the Division of Public Health. The program costs will be funded through a 5-year, $4 million federal grant. In a letter to the state's legislative leaders, Governor Walker says the declaration will not draw money from the Disaster Relief Fund or from additional state general funds. Governor Walker will announce more information on his plan tomorrow. Alaska's budget reserves could be gone in 10 years if the state government doesn't take action to balance its budget, the legislature's nonpartisan finance expert said today. Legislative Finance Director David Teal says by 2027, whether Alaskans receive permanent fund dividends each year would depend on annual fund earnings.
You would earn money in FY27. And you just don't know whether those earnings in that year would be sufficient to make the payments.
In a House Finance Committee hearing, Teal mapped out different scenarios for the state government's future based on the plans put out by Governor Bill Walker and lawmakers. Under Walker's plan, the state budget would be stable and permanent fund dividends would also be relatively flat at $1,000. A House Finance Committee bill would reintroduce an income tax. According to a model that Teal's office built, the bill would allow for higher dividend growth than Walker's plan, and it would close the state's deficit sooner. North Pole Republican Representative Tammy Wilson says there would continue to be room for dividends if the state makes deeper cuts to government. She noted that the Republican-led Senate majority has called for $750 million in budget cuts over the next 3 years.
The bigger question, as you just said, if we don't reduce the budget, is does government grab all that money for themselves and tell the people, too bad, you don't get any?
State Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck says there's little to no room for further cuts without eliminating services that residents depend on or pushing the tax burden onto local municipalities.
So essentially, when state expenditure cuts that don't recognize ongoing needs are pass-through solutions. They're simply taking the state's burden and putting it on somebody else.
The House Finance Committee will hear public testimony on the income tax and permanent fund bill on Friday. A state House lawmaker has released another bill proposing changes to the state's oil and gas tax credit regime. Anchorage Democrat Les Garrett debuted his bill called the Fair Share for Alaska's Oil Act today. Among the changes proposed in the bill is an increase in the state's current minimum tax from 4% up to 10% as oil prices rise.
We can't afford to run a state when Prudhoe Bay is only paying a 4% tax. It's tiny. So as prices go up and companies get more profitable, we say the tax should go up fairly.
Guerra says his bill is intended to supplement a bill debuted by other members of the House Majority Coalition last week. That bill would also make major changes to the current oil tax credit structure.
They're focusing mostly on tax credits, and we've all decided we should throw out the best ideas that we have and then see which ones we can get support for and pass.
Representatives from the oil and gas industry have repeatedly told lawmakers this session that they want the tax structure to remain stable. And Guerra says he's aiming for an equitable split of profits from oil production in his bill, but thinks there will be pushback from the industry.
Oh, I think the industry has its duty to protect its shareholders, and I have a duty to protect my voters who are my shareholders. They're going to say a penny in taxes will, you know, drive them off the edge.
The bill hasn't yet been scheduled for committee hearings. A leaking gas pipeline in Cook Inlet is drawing concern from environmental groups and state and federal agencies. The leak is coming from a pipeline owned by Hillcorp, a private company that's now the biggest oil and gas producer in the inlet. A local environmental group today announced it will sue the company in 60 days if the leak isn't addressed. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Footage taken from a helicopter provides a look at a gas leak first reported last week in Cook Inlet. The video, emailed to reporters by environmental group Cook Inlet Keeper, shows gas steadily burbling to the water surface as chunks of ice float nearby. Hillcorp owns the pipeline. It carries natural gas from shore to fuel two platforms built in 1964 and 1967. Along with the footage, Cook Inlet Keeper provided reporters with a letter it sent to Hillcorp CEO Jeffrey Hildebrand. The environmental group told Hildebrand it intends to sue the company in 60 days, claiming Hillcorp is violating the Federal Clean Water Act. Bob Shavelson is director of advocacy for Cook Inlet Keeper.
We just feel there's an obligation on Hillcorp to do the right thing, shut down this pipeline, deal with this antiquated infrastructure they have in Cook Inlet, and operate responsibly.
Last week, Cook Inlet Keeper asked state and federal agencies to force Hillcorp to shut down the pipeline. According to information Hillcorp provided to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC, the company has reduced the flow of gas through the pipeline. It's estimated to be leaking between 225,000 to 325,000 cubic feet of gas per day. Shivelson says his group considers this a big leak.
It's enough to heat probably around 700 households in South Central Alaska every day.
In a statement, Hillcorp said the safety of its people and the environment are its top priorities, but the company argues it would be unsafe to shut down the pipeline. In an email, spokeswoman Lori Nelson said shutting in the line would put it at risk of taking in water, freezing, and potentially rupturing. But fixing the leak is proving a challenge. According to Nelson, Hillcorp is monitoring ice conditions around the leak, but it can't dispatch divers until the company decides it is safe. DEC reports it may be some time until the leak is fixed, but an agency spokeswoman could not provide a more specific timeline. DEC agrees with Hillcorp that it would be unsafe to shut down the pipeline. The state agency is characterizing the leak's risk to public health and safety as small. But DEC also reports it's hard to quantify the leak's environmental impact. The state agency has asked Hillcorp to provide an environmental monitoring plan. Federal agencies are also worried about the leak's environmental consequences. Julie Spiegel is a spokesperson for NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region.
We are definitely concerned that this incident could have adverse impacts to marine life, particularly marine mammals. And our greatest concern is for the endangered Cook Inlet beluga whales and impacts, possible impacts to their critical habitat.
Hillcorp has until February 20th to respond to the state's request for more information about the leak. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, found throughout Alaska, starfish literally falling apart. A look at star wasting disease.
We saw a lot of dismembered true star arms floating around.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly voted to introduce an ordinance last night that would put an end to the invocation that begins each meeting. The Kenai Peninsula Borough is involved in an ongoing lawsuit with the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska over the policy. The ordinance was approved for introduction in a 5-4 vote, with Assembly members Stan Wells, Dale Bagley, Brent Hebert, and Paul Fisher voting against. A public hearing on the proposed ordinance is scheduled for March 21st. A watchdog group is raising questions about whether new tugboats planned for Prince William Sound are up to the job of escorting oil tankers through the region. As Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, the new tugs are part of a major transition taking place in the system set up to prevent oil spills after the Exxon Valdez.
Last year, the operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, surprised communities in Prince William Sound when it announced it would be parting ways with its longtime tugboat operator and bringing in a new company, Louisiana-based Edison Schuest Offshore. One reason for the switch is that Edison Schuest committed to building all new vessels to replace the current aging fleet. Those include the tugboats that escort oil tankers to and from the pipeline terminal in Valdez and barges standing by in case of a major spill. But now a report is raising questions about the design of those new boats. Donna Schantz is head of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, which commissioned the report. She says tugboats play a major role in preventing oil spills, and they have to be able to do that work in pretty rough conditions.
In terms of the intended purpose of these tugs, they need to save a fully laden tanker in seas of up to 15 feet and winds of 45 knots.
The Citizens Council was created by Congress to provide local oversight after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Schantz says they're closely watching the transition between operators.
It's the largest changeover of equipment and personnel that the system has seen since it was created after the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. And so we just want to make sure the level of care is taken to make sure we don't lose any of the safeguards that we worked so hard to put into place.
Alyeska's choice of a new operator raised some eyebrows when it was announced last year. Edison Schuest has operations all around the world, but it's perhaps best known in Alaska for the Avik tugboat, which was towing Shell's Arctic drill rig, the Kulik, when it grounded near Kodiak in 2012. The Citizens Council hired naval architect Robert Allen to review Edison Schuest's plans for the new tugs. And his firm raised concerns about several issues, including a bow shape he worries might slow the tugs down and collect water in high seas. Allen calls the designs less than ideal for what's supposed to be a state-of-the-art new fleet.
I don't in any way, and certainly didn't say in my report, that there's anything about either of these designs that is any way unsafe. It's just a question of it could be better.
Allen also says the information he received didn't include evidence that design testing was done to make sure the boats could handle rough conditions. But Alyeska says it's confident in the tug designs. Spokesperson Michelle Egan says the company takes Allen's report seriously. But she says his firm only reviewed limited preliminary plans, which in some cases have already changed.
We've gone through the report. We have identified a number of areas where changes were already made in the design. And then there are clearly places in the report where there is a professional difference of opinion between two different sets of marine architects.
One of those differences of opinion is the bow shape, which Egan says hasn't changed. She points out the new vessels come with new benefits, including more horsepower. And she says Alyeska will be sharing more information as the transition unfolds. Donna Schantz of the Citizens Council says that information can't come soon enough. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
After decades of conservation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has submitted a proposal to open a subsistence hunt for the emperor goose in Alaska. An egg hunt for cackling Canada geese could follow. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
It's been a generation since Alaskans legally tasted emperor goose. In the early 1980s, populations of a number of different geese were in trouble. Emperor goose numbers plunged by more than half to less than 45,000 birds. In 1987, hunting for the geese closed, and it stayed closed for the past 30 years. 2 years ago, the emperor goose population rose high enough for managers to begin considering a hunt. Last year, the population hit an estimated 177,000 birds, and together, the three groups, tribal, state, and federal representatives in the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council, created and passed a plan to open a hunt for emperor geese. Patty Schwallenberg, executive director of the council, calls it a victory.
It's a victory for tribes in Alaska, but it's a victory for co-management in general because we did it together.
The effort began as just education, to explain which geese were vulnerable, and people agreed to limit their harvest. That collaboration, which included the Association of Village Council Presidents, became the Co-Management Council. Underlying it are treaties with many countries stretching the entire flyway from summer to winter habitats. Between 80 to 90% of the emperor goose population breeds on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The birds are only found in Alaska and a peninsula in eastern Russia. Crystal Leonetti, an Alaska Native Affairs specialist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, says in Alaska, residents work together to grow the goose population.
We recognize the great sacrifice that elders have made to not have a taste of that special food for a long time.
But Leonetti cautions that the population is still vulnerable. It's about 60,000 birds above the threshold to sustain a hunt. Part of the problem is emperor geese don't behave like other geese.
So females don't nest every year. And another thing about their behavior that's peculiar is that they tend to stick together as a family unit. And when one is injured or taken by a predator or shot for subsistence harvest, the rest of them will stick around. So they'll either keep circling or they'll land and stay there near the one that was injured or taken.
The emperor goose subsistence hunt is proposed for April through August of this year with no permit or bag limit. The general hunt is proposed for the fall and winter and would issue unlimited permits with a 1,000 bird harvest limit for the state. Each region would be allocated a harvest number with 125 birds dedicated to the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. Public comment on the proposed hunt will be accepted through March 13th. Another proposal submitted by the Association of Village Council Presidents Waterfowl Conservation Committee would open cackling Canada geese to egg gathering on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Sea star wasting syndrome was first documented in Ketchumak Bay in 2014, but it wasn't until last summer that the mysterious infection began killing sea stars in large numbers. Nearly 6 months later, the long-term effects of the die-off remain unclear. KBBI's Shayla Farzan reports.
Even to the trained eye, the first signs of sea star wasting syndrome are easy to miss.
There tend to be these white lesions. It's kind of what looks like could be scars or raw spots from a bird pecking at it or something like that.
Katie Gavanis is a master's student at the University of Washington. She began monitoring sea stars in Ketchumak Bay in 2014 as part of a project with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. At the time, most of the sea stars in the areas she monitored appeared healthy, with only about 10% showing signs of wasting syndrome. But last summer, the infection appeared to spread. Gavanis watched as true stars, the classic five-arm species, died in record numbers. In many cases, they virtually disintegrated, losing multiple arms.
It was pretty eerie, actually. We saw a lot of dismembered True Star arms floating around. If the currents and waves were just right, you would get this line of True Star arms along the surf line on the beach.
Other species, like the sunflower star, dissolved into what she calls a pile of goo.
What you started to see were what looked like someone had taken a sunflower star and kind of put it in a blender and poured it out in a crevice in the tide pool.
Infected sea stars have appeared along the Pacific coast since the 1970s. But the extent of this latest outbreak, stretching from Baja California to Alaska, is new. In 2014, researchers identified a virus in infected sea stars. But they also found the virus present in preserved museum samples dating back to the 1940s, long before the outbreak began. That suggests there might be other factors contributing to the outbreak, such as changes in temperature or pH. Gavena says another big unknown is how the loss of sea stars will affect intertidal habitats as a whole. Because sea stars are important predators of other marine invertebrates, like urchins and mussels, their disappearance could have cascading effects on species diversity.
The big thing that I take away from all this is that there's a lot that we do not yet know. And it's pretty fascinating to look at a lot of the connections and also very humbling to realize that there's a lot more that is going on out there than we grasp right now.
Staff with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies returned to monitoring sites in Kachemak Bay in late January. Although they didn't see any signs of the disease, they also didn't find any true stars or sunflower stars, the two species hit hardest by wasting syndrome last summer. It's still too soon to say how the die-off will affect sea stars in Kachemak Bay. That's because they often retreat to deeper waters in the winter, making monitoring difficult. Coastal Studies staff and local volunteers will continue tracking sea star populations in the region throughout the year. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shayla Farzon in Homer, Ann Hillman, Rachel Waldholtz, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.